Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. If up the black police, that 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coin tail pro. Show, they got me.
So this morning what we're going to talk about, I guess I can call it shampoo. Okay? Now all of you know that when you're going to go down, you're going to go down and clean your carpeting. You go down to the store, you get the machine, and you go in and buy a little thing called shampoo to clean the carpet. And what shampoo does is really it takes the sham out and leaves the poo in. Okay? And that's what's been going on through history with black folk. They keep taking the sham out and leaving the poo in. So this morning, we're going to do a little shampooing, okay? And we're going to start off, and I'm going to show you, take you right through history again, through a second segment of history, and we're going to start dealing with some of the issues about reparations. And everything I tell you must be taken in that context if you really, truly are going to understand the nature of reparations. That's the only way you're going to do it. You must understand the nature of it. And what it's saying is this, what I'm saying to you, is that reparations is not a nicety. It's not something nice to have for black folk. It is now an absolute necessity. If you do not get reparations soon, black folk, as I told you before, are through. Reparation is not a nicety, it's a necessity. Now, I first wrote my book, Black Labor, White Wealth. That's what I was telling you then. That's been 7 years ago. When I wrote the first affirmative action plan in the United States in 1971 that Jeb Bush just killed in Florida, as you all been reading about in the paper, I wrote that plan in 1971 as reparations for black folk. And nobody was giving anything to black folk for reparations at that time, but it was killed off within 6 months. It was converted over to and converted to things for minority, women, children, gay, handicapped, midgets, humpbacks, everybody else. Everybody but black folk. And it was diluted down and black folk got nothing out of it. So affirmative action was dead 6 months after I put it on the floor. But now they've been given the pretense that somehow they've had affirmative action all these years. And they haven't had anything for black folk. Black folk haven't gotten anything out of affirmative action. And so in a way, I'm glad that affirmative action is now dead. I want them to bury it, you know, and throw flowers, commemorate, and let it go. And I want black folks to go to reparations. Because that's the only way. You got to have reparations. There's no other choice. You got to have reparations. And that's what I'm going to be talking about this morning. But also I'm going to try to show you in my little discussion with you is all the things I want you to be aware of, the tricks and the games. That's why I'm going to pick a certain part of history to show you the games. And you all take your little notes and try to remember these things. So when you see the same games reoccurring all the time, you know what the game is, what they're up to. And so that's what we'll be talking about, reparations for black folk. Now let's start talking about reparations for black folk. And let's pick a point. Let's take Juneteenth, since this is Juneteenth weekend, the Juneteenth celebrations. Now, I talked to you earlier about the importance of culture. So we have to have Juneteenth as a culture process because we don't have any culture. And so when you hear me criticize Juneteenth in a few seconds, it's not because I want you all to disassociate or discontinue celebrating Juneteenth. It's just I want you to do it in the right light, in the right tone, so you understand what the games are. It's just like if I were to start talking about Kwanzaa right now. I don't want you all not to celebrate Kwanzaa because we have to have culture. We don't have any culture. The culture we used to have, white stole it from you. All your culture has been stolen and exploited by everybody else. See, you right now, your culture in this country, your major contribution would have been your genius. See, black folk have a genius for creating music, dance, language, slang, you see, art, and even the way we wear our clothes, that was our culture. But everybody has taken the exploit and gotten rich off it. Every time you come up with anything, they take it from you because you integrate. You see, one time Dixieland music was black. You see, jazz was black. Gospel was black. Blues was black. Rhythm and blues, rhythm was black. Now they got your music. That is a $103 billion a year industry, and black folk get less than 1% out of it. You see, even the Hispanics got your music now. They take African music and mix it with black music and call it Latin beat. See, everybody makes money off of black folk. Because when you integrate it, you open yourself up. Integration means filleting yourself, saying, come get whatever you want. And you integrate, they went inside and took everything out and left you with nothing. And that's why you cannot make it under the integration process. Nobody else opens themselves up like I said, come get what you want, take it, and make a living off of it. That's why now they have a rock and roll, you know, museum for whites and call Elvis Presley the king of rock. Or rock and roll, because it used to be rhythm and blues until white folks discovered it. See, they discovered black music like they discovered America. So then once they discovered it, then they became theirs. And we just gave it to them. So we got to have culture. And if I were talking about Kwanzaa, see, friend, I would tell black folks, so you got to understand that we got to have Kwanzaa. Because Kwanzaa gives us something to celebrate at Christmas other than the white form of Christmas celebrating. But Kwanzaa comes out of Swahili. And Swahili is a fabricated language. That's not a real language. A fabricated language that was created by the initial original slave traders. And that was Arabs. The Arabs started Swahili. They started Swahili intentionally to be able to communicate with Africans, black Africans. And so that's a fabricated language. So if we talk about we're going to avoid the white man's language and run over to start dealing with Swahili and dealing with the Arab language, see, you just jump from the fire into the frying pan. Doesn't make any difference one way or the other. But again, we need the celebration, but you need to understand that. Now, the same thing is true with Juneteenth. And see, all this will give you the context for reparations now so you understand the issues. See, Juneteenth, the same thing. See, Juneteenth started off as a major celebration in Galveston, Texas in 1865. It's where when black folk finally got the word, the last ones in the country to get the word that they were free. You see? And they went out and started celebrating, and we passed it on down, you know, through the South and the Southwest up to this point as a major day for celebrating. But in reality, what you're going to find out in a few minutes is that you have never been free. They never gave you your freedom. And the little game going on behind the whole thing about emancipation and also about Juneteenth, and we're going to figure out what it is. So we start getting our reparations, we're going to get it the right way. Now, let's go back now. See, let's go back to two. Let's take Juneteenth as a kickoff point since this is Juneteenth weekend. If you go back now to, let's say, about 1860, when Abraham Lincoln, the so-called great emancipator that you all will be celebrating over Juneteenth, the great emancipator, Abraham Lincoln, President Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln didn't do one single solitary thing positive for black folk. One of the biggest scoundrels and culprits ever lived in terms of black folk. So you start talking about celebrating Juneteenth and Abraham Lincoln, you got to see that you can be deal a double deck. You're back to the shampoo again. See, you're back to, you start talking about great emancipator and how he freed the slaves. There goes the shampoo. Because you see, and that's what happened in 1963. We had the great Martin Luther King March, and I had a dream speech. See, where did they go to give that speech? But at the foot of the great emancipator, Abraham Lincoln. They stood at his feet and said, I got a dream, but with Abraham Lincoln standing behind you. He's one of the biggest scoundrels to black folk on earth. And even when our friends, the Farrakhan, when he had the Million Man March, you see, because they don't have the truth. They don't know some of the similes they get caught in. So they didn't go to the foot of the great emancipator and sit at the foot of Abraham Lincoln and give the Million Man March speech. You see, whether it's Martin Luther King or Farrakhan or our people, we keep getting tricked because we don't understand what's going on. Now, if you go back to 1860, Abraham Lincoln had absolutely no interest in black folk. No interest in black folk. His interest was a very simple thing. All he wanted to do, as a matter of fact, every speech he gave in my research shows that what he said is that I can't stand black folk. I don't need black folk. Don't want black folk. And what I would ideally like to do is to recolonize black folk and ship black folk out of the country. I would like to ship them either to Latin America, Central America, or back to Africa just to get rid of them. And see, and that's what he wanted to do in 1860. But you see, he couldn't do it because he checked around trying to figure out how he could do it. After he became president, he found out something, which is a point that you all got to remember because we're going to talk about these things later. He found out that white folk needed these black folk they couldn't stand. See, they needed them. They needed poor black folk because, see, no white person wanted to do the dirty, nasty, dangerous work. So black folk then were needed as a labor class, point one. They needed your labor. The second group that came to Lincoln, the great emancipator that we like to worship in Washington, D.C., was a group of merchants, all the merchants, all over the country. You had people like all the people tied into the textile industry, the cotton industry, the insurance industry, the sugar industry, the tobacco industry, the rice industry, the indigo industry. See, all those people came and said, no, you can't get rid of those black folk. Because you see, also, because people like us in the cotton industry and the leather industry, we need them as consumers. We need them as consumers. We need those blacks that you call darkies as consumers. Because right now, look, we know we got 5 million of them, and I know that every year, every slave owner is going to buy 2 pair of clothes for them, a pair of summer clothes and a pair of winter clothes. And those clothes are made out of what we call nigger cotton. That's the roughest part of the cotton that nobody else could wear. It's rough, tough. It's just almost so rough it takes the skin off the body. But that's what they made the clothes off of. So you had whites who had these industries. All they did was make what they called nigger clothes for slaves. They knew they had that market. And the same thing with the leather industry. They knew it was from the leather industry that every slave would get 2 pair of shoes a year. They would give them a pair of sandals and a pair of brogans. Okay? And so they knew that was so a white leather maker said, hey, I know for a fact I'm gonna sell 5 million pair of sandals and 5 million pair of brogans every year. That is a built-in lock market. I got black folks as a lock consumer market. So I got black folks trapped two ways. One, you see, as I told you a few minutes ago, is because we need their labor. And secondly, we need them as consumers. And that's the only way they didn't send blacks out of the country. They had one other third reason that popped up, and they tried to deal with it through Lincoln, was that the white slave owners said, but on the other hand, they said, don't you know we've invested something like $8 billion? That we got more money invested in slaves than we got in all the businesses in the United States and all levels of government put together. The biggest form of investment in the United States was money invested in slaves. And they didn't want to lose that money. And so what Lincoln did to try to resolve that, he says, well, what I'll do is that let me give you all some reparations. And if I decide to send them out of the country, I'll give you some reparations. So he sent a bill over to Congress to give reparations to white slave owners, saying if you all were free to slaves, I'll give you reparations for it. And the only place they got it was in Washington, D.C., which in Washington, D.C. just happened to be the slave capital of the world at that time. And so in Washington, D.C., it went through where they awarded something like $300 for every black slave that was released by a white owner. And that was reparation for whites. Now the whole context is set. So people say, well, the war started now. What are they going to do with all these blacks? So we go from about 1861 to about 1862. Now, remember I just told you these points now about they needed blacks for labor and consumer, and they wanted reparations. Remember those 3 points. Now, here comes 1862. In 1862, we're into a war, and the North is losing the war. The South is beating the devil out of the North. The South is beating the devil out of the North. There was no way that the North could win the war. No way they could win it. They couldn't win it for some very simple fact. Fact one, they couldn't win it because the South had all the wealth. The South had all the wealth. The North did not have any wealth. The North was a poor area of the country. They didn't have any money. Because, see, slavery, I just told you, you had $8 billion just in black slaves alone. And a white person in the South who owned any slaves had a massive amount of money over Northern. As a matter of fact, a white person in the South who had what we call a gang plantation, we use gang slavery, he had 400 times the wealth of a typical Northern white. A white man in the South with two slaves had more money than the average white male in the North by throwing his family, his home, his car, I mean his wagons, animals, business, anything else, throwing together. That's where all your wealth was. A black person, a black slave, was a walking American Express card. Every white person could make a living just by having one slave. All they do is put him up in the morning, send him out to work, and go back to bed, and wait for him to come home in the evening, and take the money from him and get paid for it. It was called rent a slave. They buy slaves and rent them out to other people up and down the road to use them. So everybody understood that. That was the name of the game, is that you got to have and own some black slaves. Now, so what we did, and so by 18, so the North couldn't win. So the North said, we got to have a plan. We got to have a plan so that the North could beat the South. Now, see, nobody's talked about freeing any slaves. Don't y'all get off on the wrong point. Nobody's talking about freeing any black folk. So now we're up to about 1862. All of a sudden, a couple of generals around Lincoln said, look, we're losing this war. We're losing the war. We're getting the devil beat out of us. What can we do? Lincoln said, I don't know. They said, I tell you what, we got a scheme. Why don't we play some games, play some trickery? Let's use a little shampoo. What we'll do is, let's turn around and put out the word that you're going to free the slaves. If you put out the word that you're going to free the slaves, what would that do to the South? See, first of all, that would create all kind of havoc for them. Because, you see, the reason they're beating us is because they got 5 million blacks there on their team in the South. You got 5 million black slaves in the South that are taking care of the white families, taking care of the yards, the garden, the food, the white families, protecting them, feeding them and clothing them and doing all the work while all the white men out fighting the war. Are y'all following me? So the South is using blacks to build the highways, the bridges, the railroads, to haul and run the wagons and hold all the supplies, and to work at the factories and the mines and the timber yards, to build the bridges, being done by black folk, so that way all the white men in the South would go out and fight the war. So at about September the 22nd, 1862, that Lincoln then announced his intentions of freeing the slaves. He said, I'm going to free the slaves. Let's see what the South would do. And then a general said, well, let's not put out anything in writing until we get a major political victory, whether it's Vicksburg or Gettysburg or something. And then we got something really to piggyback on and announce that you're really going to do it. And so that way, and if we go ahead and do it, maybe that'll really be a big incentive. So that was in September 22nd, 1862. The word went out. The South was very leery about whether or not the North was going to free these slaves. And so then come about January the 1st, 1863, he then said, well, what we're going to do is that we're still losing the war, so let's then just wait. And so they decided to wait, so let's wait a few years because they're losing the war. But the generals had picked up the fact that he was going to free the slaves. So guys like General William Tecumseh Sherman, he's in now fighting in the South. So he says, well, I'm going to take that up and follow through with it. Let's go ahead and do it because I'm a general. I'm fighting down here, not the president. I'm fighting. And if we can destroy the South by tricking them and thinking we're going to free the slaves, let's do it. So then he comes up this whole thing about let's take the land, all the confiscated land. And the property from these white plantation owners, every time we take over a plantation, let's take it. Now let's take it and divide it up and give 40 acres and a mule to every black. And let's give every black 40 acres and a mule. And that way, even if Lincoln hasn't moved, we can still do something to devastate the South emotionally. And so Tecumseh Sherman then says, now all the land I take from these white plantation owners, I'm going to give it to black folk. And he goes over and sets aside a long strip of land running from Charleston, South Carolina, all the way down to Jacksonville, Florida, and all those islands off the coast there. He said that's going to belong to black folk. That black folk are going to own all that land from South Carolina all the way down to the top of Florida. And they're going to own all the islands. He said, I'm going to give that to them. And as soon as he set it up to do it, guess who called him in shortly after that, maybe a few months or a year after, whenever he started, because maybe about a year after, because a lot of blacks got over there and got the land. A lot of blacks did get on those islands. If you go, and some of those islands that you all go over and watch now was like Hilton Head. See, Hilton Head Island was all black. See, blacks went over there and got Hilton Head. And some of them got guns and said, you ain't going to take nothing from us. And also John's Island became all black. And also Amelia Island off the coast of Florida, Jacksonville, Florida, became all black. But see, nowadays they're no longer black because whites have taken them back now and made them into luxury islands for whites. But blacks took those islands, all of down that coast, and took that land under Sherman's order, about 40 acres and a mule. And now, about a year after that, our esteemed emancipator of black folk jumped in and said, you can't do that. You can't, take back that order and force Sherman to kill the program, to not give black folks any land. Your great emancipator, Abraham Lincoln, says blacks don't get any land. And a lot of blacks already had that land over there, and whites went in and tried to take it away from them later on. So the great emancipator started whizzing around. And that was about 1864 now. Now we come to about 1865. Now what he said, now at this point in time, he's going to put out what we call the Emancipation Proclamation. So he put out the Emancipation Proclamation, but the Emancipation Proclamation took effect as of January 1, 1863. He expected black folk to come out and celebrate that so he can get the South all riled up by the blacks being free, even though he knew black folk, in fact, would not be free. He put that out on January the 1st. But nobody bought into it, and blacks didn't come out to celebrate. Now, did I say 1863? I mean, 1865. That thing came out, was announced at that time. But here's what happened, though. When the word got out, black folk didn't come out on January 1st because, see, my people won't come out in the wintertime to celebrate anything. See, that's too cold. So black folk didn't come out. Black folk didn't come out. So the Emancipation Proclamation then was sort of postponed. It was written for that point in time, enacted at that point in time. The word didn't get down until about May 18th. They picked it up where public officials in the South says blacks are free, and most people got the word in May that black folk were free. It didn't get to Texas, the Galveston, Texas, until June 19th that black folk were supposedly free. Now y'all following that sequence for me, okay? So all that's been moving across the country saying that black folk are now free. But let me go back now behind this little game. They did not want to free blacks, as I said to you a few minutes ago. What they wanted to do was to disorganize the South by giving the pretense that somehow black folk were free. So here's what your good esteemed President Abraham Lincoln did. In the Emancipation Proclamation, what he said was this: I now hereby declare all the blacks who are in the Confederacy as slaves as now being free. Now, listen to his logic. He's in the North with the Union, and the South is a Confederacy, and what he says is now all the blacks who are in the Confederacy, on the group that's broken away from the United States, y'all are free over there. Now see, somebody's front light, that porch light was on, but nobody's upstairs at home. Now I guess they figured the whole world was stupid. If you, in fact, if they've broken away from you and that's your enemy you're fighting, how are you going to free somebody that you don't have any control over? So they had no control over those people. So he didn't free anybody in the Confederacy. He did not free that order. The Emancipation Proclamation did not free any slaves, because the slaves he was talking about weren't even in the Union up north. They were in the South. So he didn't free them. Now, he could have freed some slaves if he wanted to, because we had all these other slaveholding states in the North, the border states, Kentucky and Tennessee and all the rest of them around in Maryland. But he didn't touch those states. He didn't touch those states. He didn't touch the states that he could have, where he could have freed slaves. He didn't. where he couldn't free slaves, he gave the pretense that he could. So therefore, the Emancipation Proclamation didn't free anybody. And more importantly, if you go back and read the Emancipation Proclamation, also what he did in the Emancipation Proclamation, trying to be slick again as a president, he put in the proclamation that any black people, any states or any whites in the slaveholding states, if you decide to come back into the Union, come back in the Union and join us in the North, you can continue to hold your slaves. Now, let me give that to you again, since you all probably missed that. I'm going to give it to you again. Also, he had in the proclamation that even though I know, now he didn't say that he knew it, but the slaves who were in the South, in those southern states, he didn't free them. But he said, though, if any of you states decide to come back in and rejoin the Union, because my whole intent is to maintain the Union, you can continue to hold your slaves. And that way, the bottom line would have been that whites would have still had slaves in the North and they still had slaves in the South. That was the logic. They didn't free anybody, but it gave the pretense of freeing black folk, and black folk were happy all over the country. Because, see, most of them couldn't read the Emancipation Proclamation. They couldn't figure all this out. So they started dancing and singing in the streets that they were free. And in fact, they didn't free not one single black any place, and gave the option to those states to come back in and get their slaves back if they wanted them. And that became the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, let's move up a little faster now. So remember that. That was a shame and gam. Nobody has freed any slaves. Now here comes the end of the war. The end of the war has come. And at this point in time, since they have been running a game on everybody, and they have not freed any slaves, the first thing you got to do with the Congress is to do what? Write what? What Constitution Amendment? The 13th Amendment, so they can actually, in reality, free you. So they had to write the 13th Amendment, saying that involuntary slavery is outlawed. The only way you can enslave a person is, in fact, what? What is it? If you've been duly convicted of a crime. Now remember that, because that's going to be a very important point now. The 13th Amendment says, again, I told you how they trick you and always put in these little clauses with the sham and game. So now they write the 13th Amendment. It says black folk are now free. And the 13th Amendment was written exclusively for black folk, even though it didn't say it. It just says that nobody, and then when you read the Constitution, you see words like nobody, all those, everyone, they always use those words whenever they talk to black folk so you couldn't have a paper trail to get out of anything. So, and we got a lot of black leaders in America always use those same ambiguous words. We want everybody to be free. All people should have rights. The only people that didn't have them was black folk. See, they're scared to say black folk. And every time you use that broad, ambiguous word, you're playing that same game they were playing back during slavery. And I keep telling our black leadership, quit trying to write things and speak broad in broad, ambiguous terms, talking about everybody, rather than talking about your own people. See, every time you start talking about... whenever you start talking about poor folk, multicultural, culture diverse, minorities, you play the game and lost. And see, everybody, they knew that in those days. So then when they wrote the 13th Amendment, they said, now let's cut out something, let's do a little more shampooing, let's write the 13th Amendment. And this time we're going to say that we're really going to free them this time. And they wrote the 13th Amendment. It says that it is now constitutionally put in the Constitution that it's illegal and unconstitutional for you to commit anybody to involuntary servitude. Then they put a comma and says, except when you've been duly convicted of a crime. And you're going to figure out how the little game goes again in a few minutes, okay? So that became the 13th Amendment. Now, right after that, what happened was that they found out that most of the states said, hey, that doesn't mean anything. You didn't say black folk in particular. You used all them words, alls and everyone. And so, and we don't know what you're talking about. And plus that, since you represent the federal government, we're the state government, you didn't say who. So as far as we're concerned, I don't care if you're talking about the Emancipation Proclamation or the 13th Amendment, we still own them, still got them. So at that point in time, the Congress stepped in. Now you had a few Republicans called radical Republicans that were committed to black folk. And they were very concerned about doing something positive for black folk beyond what the president tried to do, because Lincoln hadn't done anything for them except run a shell and pee game on them, shampoo. So at that point, those congressmen stepped up. Charles Sumner and Thaddeus Stevenson and Congressman Bingaman. They said, let's do something positive. And I must tell you up front that the reason those two congressmen in particular, Stevens and Sumner, were very interested in doing something for black folk, both of them had black mistresses, you see. Even though they were white, they had black mistresses and black children. So they got up and said, we're going to have to do something for these black folk, you know. And so what Stevens got up before the Congress and said, and this is why, again, you got to remember this, when we start talking about reparation in a few seconds. What he says is that you got to do something for black folk. Contrary to all this shampooing you've been hearing from the president and everybody else, is that black people in America can only be one of two things. Either you're going to be a slave or you're going to be free. You're going to be a slave or you will be free. He says, if you do not redistribute some of the wealth, resources, power, privileges, and controls to black folks' hands, black folk will always be slaves. Now, this was said before the Congress in 1865. Stevenson and Sumner says, you cannot turn black folk loose in this country. You cannot turn loose 5 million black folk, penniless, broke, no land, no clothes, no food, no animals, no land, no weapons, no tools, and no money, and say they're free. He said, you're running shampoo on them. It will not work. You cannot turn them loose without giving them something. You cannot turn loose all these black folk without minimally giving them 40 acres, a mule, and $100. He picked up on what Sherman had said, General Sherman had said with the blacks off the islands of the East Coast, is that minimally, if black folk, and he said, until the day comes that you redistribute wealth and resources into these black folks' hands, they will always be slaves. And that was said in 1865. Now, based on that, they then turned around and wrote the first civil rights law in the country. It's called the Civil Rights Act of 1865. They wrote that specifically to be economic development for black folk. And in there, they talked about economics. It was economics. It had nothing to do with civil, had nothing to do with social, had nothing to do with voting, had nothing to do with getting along with people, had nothing to do with integration. What it was talking about is you had to redistribute some wealth and resources into the hands of black folk. But now that Lincoln has been assassinated, you get another scoundrel as the president. His name is Andrew Johnson. They knew what reparations was. And what you all need to know what reparations is, so that you won't get confused as things begin to develop, because reparations will be the hottest issue in this country from now on. That's what I was prophesying to you all 7 years ago, that reparations will be the hottest issue in this country. Reparations means compensation in the form of money, materials, or labor for injustices committed. That's what reparations mean. So reparations has always been economic justice. That's why my book, Black Labor, White Wealth, A Search for Power and Economic Justice, is about. That you're talking about economic justice, you talk about reparations. It means creating a structural economic inequity. So those congressmen understood that. So they asked for the 40 acres and a mule and $100. And they sent it over to Johnson, who was the new president of the United States, and he vetoed it. Saying black folk don't need anything, they're now free, quit giving them handouts. And now they're free, let them live and survive on their own. And they use a term, what says, either let the ends work or starve. Okay? Now at that point in time, they kill the bill. Now these same congressmen came right back again, later on that year, and wrote the second Civil Rights Act. And that Civil Rights Act, again, went through the Congress, it came out, it then became the Civil Rights Act of 1866. That was the second Civil Rights Act. This time they had to tone it down some. And again, they started working the gains and they were losing their power, so they had to start putting in all this all, you all, everybody, everyone, all this broad, ambiguous language again. And they passed the act again. This time they sent it over to Andrew Johnson. And they overrode, he tried to veto it again, they overrode him and it went into law. That law is still on the books, called the Civil Rights Act of 1866. Now, that gave black folk the only thing positive, and that even that, wasn't that strong, but at least that was the first time they ever got anything that gave them a legal right to do anything. It was the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And following that, they then said, well, we'll take that 1866 Act, we're now going to convert it over to another thing called the 14th Amendment. And we're going to try to put as much of that in there as possible because nobody still would accept black folk as being free and would do anything for a black. They say, hey, these black folk think they're free. They really think, they still think they're emancipated. They think they're free. Even though we did not give them the 40 acres and the mule, they still think they're free. And say, wait, we're going to show you how we're going to get them. Let's go back to the 13th Amendment unless we got them again. Well, the 13th Amendment says it's unconstitutional to have involuntary servitude except when duly convicted of a crime. They said, we got them again because our people know how to play this game, the shampoo. So what they said is now, let's now write laws called the Black Codes in 1867. And the Black Codes will criminalize black folk. And we'll put out all kind of laws to make sure we got them again. So they wrote the Black Codes throughout the South and a lot of northern areas and forced them. And those Black Codes then says, we got you where we want you. Because all we got to do now is put out all these laws. Like, for instance, that a black person must have a signed contract to work for a white man by January the 1st of every year, or he can be arrested for being idle and vagrant. He had to have a contract in his hand that he could not be, so that tied blacks down. They create all kind of laws about blacks being guilty of looking out of the same window that white folks are looking out of, or having dogs that were barking. And one of the biggest ones that get arrested black folk for and criminalized them was called playing games with white folk. And so when they started that, now this set up a whole new system of thing. They passed those laws. And so blacks didn't get the reparations. No reparations come yet because they still shampooing everything. So now what the North says, hold it. Yes, the South has passed these black codes, but we're not going to get involved again. Because right now whites want to re-enslave black folk. Why should we get involved? They said, we got what we want. We fought the Civil War. And all these things I mentioned to you are important now when we start talking about reparations, so watch me now. We fought the Civil War. We didn't fight the Civil War for black folk. We fought the Civil War for the North. We fought the Civil War so the North could take over the wealth of the South and so they could industrialize and build industries and factories. We fought the war so the North could build factories. We fought the war so that we can whites had control of the Congress. Another thing about the three-fifths of a human being, whites were using that to control the Congress in the United States by counting blacks in the census, but not letting blacks hold in the political office. So whites got the benefit of saying, I represent all those blacks, even though they can't vote. And so whites were controlling the government. So that's what the North was fighting the Civil War for, was to take away the wealth and the control of the South, the power of the South. And so what the North says then is that you all can have those blacks now. If you want to do the black codes, fine, I don't care. They want 40 acres of mule, we're not going to give them the reparations, 40 acres of mule. And so they said, what we need now is some kind of an instrument to make sure that we need the South to be redeveloped. We got to redevelop the South. But we can't do anything to help black folk, and we don't want to hurt the North. So how do we do it? And people say, well, why do you need black folk? They said, well, we still gotta have black folk to pick this cotton. See, we still gotta have somebody to pick the cotton. I told y'all we still need that black labor. We still need black labor. Yes, they are so-called free on paper, but since we didn't give them the 4 acres and the mule, they're still not free. We still need them. How can we use them? And so they said, we got to create an instrument that will keep black folk and yet get them, and we still need the cotton. So what they did then, they created something called the Freedmen's Bureau in 1868. The Freedmen's Bureau is what later on created all of our black universities. And what they did, they took the Freedmen's Bureau and set up a special commission that would go around through the South and supposedly, in quotes, to help black folk. And the Congress appropriated some monies for them. And what they were sort of been doing then was trying to give black folk a little bit of food, a little bit of so-called minimum welfare, and to help them prepare to be free. But what they decided to do was to use the Freedmen's Bureau in a very slick scheme again to re-enslave black folk. And what they did then is they came up with a whole scheme saying, we still need black folks' labor. So the Freedmen's Bureau then set up a thing called a contract system, where they drew up a little contract, which if a black person signed it, it tied him to the first spot. See, in other words, he put his name in the first spot with an X and tied him into the white man at the South. Okay? And the Freedmen's Bureau went all throughout the South, said they're going to do it in such a way where the white, because the whites in the North needed cotton. Still needed cotton. Even though they destroyed the South, they moved all those factories and all the cotton from the South to the North. And now the North got all the plants in the South, and they needed factories. And at that point in time, in the late 1860s, over 60% of all this country's export and wealth was in cotton. They were still shipping cotton out. And they need to sell cotton because like England was buying something like 1 billion pounds a year. And they needed that cotton, but they didn't, and they could have solved a racial problem at that point in time by just simply saying, if we need cotton and we need cotton production, why don't we give the 40 acres and the mule to the black people and let them raise the cotton and buy it from them? You know, if the country needs cotton to survive because that's our major industry, why don't we give land, mules, and money to black folk, let them raise the cotton and buy it from them? And see, the racism in this country was so acute and so strong, they said, don't give them anything. What you do is to go around and sign up the contract and make them work for whites, and we'll buy it from whites. And almost every state in the United States then passed laws saying that black folk couldn't even raise some of this cotton and tobacco. They took the Freedmen's Bureau in 1868 and said, look, what we're going to do now is that we got to figure out a way not to give these black folk 4 days of mule and no reparations. Except the Freedmen's Bureau said, go get them a signed contract. Because, yes, we can go give black folk 4 days of mule and still get our cotton, but we don't want black folk to have any wealth and power. No wealth and power for them. So what they did, and after about 3 years, the Freedmen's Bureau went throughout the South, signed up every black person, every black farmer, every black family to contracts. Those contracts then locked black folk into what you call sharecropping and peonage. Locked them in, and not only did it lock them in, but here's what it did to them. Locked them in, but what it did when it locked them in, they told them that was voluntary for blacks to sign it. But if he couldn't sign it, he would get no welfare, no food, nothing else. And once he signed those contracts, he gave away all of his rights again. See, now he had no right to quit. He had no right to protest a contest. He could not strike. He could not demand higher wages. And in that contract, what it told him in the sharecropping was that if you, in fact, would go back and work for your same white master that you used to work for and sign a contract with him, that if you work with him, he'll give you the seeds and the animals. He'll let you use his land. He'll give you the seeds, let you use his horse. But you have to do the work because they needed your labor. And at the end of the year, based on how well you produce, you can have earned your care during that year, and you might get a profit of any profits that are left over. And guess who kept the books? Kept the books, and never did black folk ever break a profit. They never broke a profit, then most of them not only didn't break a profit, but see, and they couldn't protest, but if they talked back, then whites could have them arrested on those black codes for being insolent and talking back to white folk. And then after once they did that, he was criminalized, then didn't have to pay him anything. And so when that happened, by 1869, 1870, most of these blacks were frozen all across the South again, locked back into slavery. And the United States government had participated in it again. Participated in all these corporations. And they wouldn't give black folk land, or even the simple 40 acres and a mule. And keeping in mind that in 1862, the last Homestead Act was passed in the United States. The last Homestead Act was passed in 1862, which means all those 11 million white immigrants I told you about a few minutes ago started coming in between 1865 and 1880, and then the other 26 million that came in to the end of the year, all of them came in here to get land while they were running the shampoo on black folk. Running the shaman game on black folk. As a matter of fact, in that period between 1862 Between 1862 and the turn of the century in 1900, the United States gave away 1 billion acres of land to whites. And black folk couldn't get an inch. Black folk did not get one inch of that out of 1 billion acres. As a matter of fact, the United States gave away more land to the United States railroads by giving them 6 miles on each side of the railroad across the United States. They gave them more land than there is in the entire state of Texas. And black folk couldn't get an inch for reparations. And you see, the game then was they locked black folk back into labor and slave them again, locked them in. And they needed us for consumers. And that went on. It went on. Let me jump up and show you how the game continues. We never got into reparations. And we still weren't free based on Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner's definition. And what they said as two white congressmen back in 1865 is that there's absolutely no way on earth black folk can ever be free and ever be emancipated unless you give them something where they can be in charge of their own lives. And that's never happened. Okay? And that's why if you look back right now, I'm telling y'all, when I talked about what the Wall Street Journal said and what the Detroit News said at the outset a few minutes ago and what Alan Greenspan said, when you were almost 98% in direct slavery and 2% in indirect slavery, that means that 100% of all the black folk in America were enslaved in 1860. But even then, you had one half or 1% of the nation's wealth. And here you are 140 years later, when you're supposedly 100% free, you still only have one half of 1% of this nation's wealth. How can you sit there and talk about you're free and emancipated and all the game of shampooing going on? And even in modern day terms, when the white newspapers tell you that the shampoo is going, you still haven't gotten the black leaders right and say, hold on a second, something's wrong. You can't keep tricking my people. As a matter of fact, when we get into reparations, I want you to have these arguments when people start telling you about why they are opposed to reparation for black folk. One of the first things you're going to hear is that we oppose to reparation for black folk because we've already paid our dues. We fought the Civil War to free black folk. You didn't fight the Civil War for black folk. As a matter of fact, on the eve of the Civil War, in 1860, they'd already done a survey and they found out something like 99% of all the white people in America were opposed to freeing black slaves. Nobody wanted to free black slaves. 99% of all the whites in America were opposed to freeing slaves. Now, all of a sudden, 150 years later, after the fact, you can say, well, we fought the war for black folk. You didn't fight the Civil War for black folk. Just like the same little game, the same game of shampoo they ran on you after the integration. Now they talk about how segregation is so bad and how every white person was in favor of integration. When it's even as late as the late early 1970s, 87% of the white folk in America in the 1970s were still opposed to integration for black folk in America, saying black folk were moving too fast and wanted too much. You see, every time there's a game, we get the shampoo. They run this same sham and leave the poo in. So now when you start talking about reparations, they can start to run these games on you again about we've already paid our dues for fighting. We died and fought to get the free black folks. They didn't die and free the black folks. Black folks are still enslaved. They have never been emancipated. If we're going to get it, we got to go back now and remember all those principles. They used us as a labor class to get wealth. They got their wealth now. We didn't get any. So we got to go back and get us a model. Now, what most people keep trying to use as a model, they want to use the Japanese. I don't want to use the Japanese. I want to use the American Indians. Now, why did I pick the American Indians? Because, see, the American Indians were the only group that was stipulated in the Constitution along with us. See, the Japanese weren't even in the country. See, when slavery was ending, I did not have one Asian in America in 1840s. I didn't have one Asian or one Hispanic. Not one Asian or one Hispanic in the entire United States in 1840. So I can't compare with those, but I did have Indians here. And Indians were stipulated in the Constitution along with us. Whenever they talked about black folk, they talked about Indians. But they didn't talk about all Indians. They only talked about those Indians who were not paying taxes. And see, this is very important. They only talked about Indians who were not paying taxes. Because you see, Indians were also classified starting in 1870 as being equal to white folk. See, all Indians were, Indians were given an option that you were never given. What they wanted the Indians to do was to assimilate and give up some of the land, they can become white. And Indian was given that right to intermarry with whites and become white. And you got a system we're going to talk about hopefully by the end of this thing. The system in this country is to is that people keep talking about, well, we're going to take over whites. You never take over whites. Whites got a process. Each group that comes in, they give you an option of becoming white at some point. So that way they'll always be the majority population.
That's the truth.
Okay, so Indians became white.
That's the truth.
Just like you've got Hispanics now coming to this country, all the Mexican, Hispanics, and Latinos. See, 99% of them is classified by immigration laws and also by their driver's license being white. They are not part of what you are. They got a different issue than you got. And you got Asians now on probation to be white. Okay. So what we're going to do then, we're going to go back and track the Indians. That's the closest thing we can track in terms of reparations. Now, how did the Indians get over and get some of the things they're getting? Indians got slick. Even though the Indians were not quite as bright as black folk were, they were slick. They didn't get the shampoo that we got, okay? Now, what did the Indians do? First of all, nobody ever said any place in the Constitution, any place else on earth, that Indians were a nation. Nobody ever said the Indians were a nation. What was happening in the country during all the period we were talking about doing the enslavement process and all the things in the 1860s, what was happening is that they were fighting Indians at the same time. All the way back when Abraham Lincoln was coming in playing this little game with black folk, they were now fighting Indians. But the difference was that you had the United States government, the federal government, fighting Indians. The federal government was responsible for protecting white folk. And so therefore, in the Constitution, when they talked about, every time they mentioned the word Indian, it was only talking about Indians because the government had to fight Indians. The Department of War had to fight Indians and protect the citizens. So Indians were stipulated for those reasons. The rest of the Indians that they who went onto a reservation, they didn't have to pay taxes. But any reservation, any Indian who was not living on a reservation, he had to pay taxes like everybody else. So that's how they divided the Indians between those living on a reservation and paying taxes, those who lived off did pay taxes. But Indians always had an option. They didn't all have to live on the reservation. They can go either way, one way or the other. So they set up this situation where Indians then were being controlled or fought by the United States federal government. So Indians in a special category. Now here's what happened. After the Indians lost most of the battles in the country, the federal government was still dealing with them. They lost, but they lost. So they tried to put most of the Indians on reservations. And they said to the Indians then, you are now basically a weak people. You've been a beaten people. And so the Indians said, well, as a beaten people, and we're on the reservation, what we're going to do, the first thing we're going to do, unlike those blacks over there, unlike those black slaves who just came out of slavery, we're not going to be like them. We're not going to be as foolish as they are. What the Indians say is what we're going to do now is that since we've lost our land, we're going to first of all lay a claim against the land. So Indians laid a claim against the land, saying that all the land in the United States originally belonged to us. We had a natural right to it. That even though we didn't have any legal documents or any deeds showing we owned it, we have a legal claim to the land. So as a legal claim to the land, therefore you took it from us, you owe us. So what the claim was based on what they call natural rights. Indians says there's a natural right to the land because we were the first ones here on it. Even though in fact they were not the first, it was black sheep before those guys got here. But we don't talk about that today. Black people were here about 11 to 12,000 years before the present day so-called Asian Indians came here. Blacks had been here already. But they said that was their land. Okay? So that's what they called natural law to lay claims against the land. So that put them. So that meant they tried to impose an indebtedness on the government. Now blacks over here who's coming free after slavery with the shampoo on them with Lincoln. See, they thought, we don't want anything. All we want is a chance to compete. We want equal opportunity. See, now Indians laid claims. All black folk wanted was an equal opportunity. Okay? Then the Indians turned around and said, we want to be into a trust relationship with the United States. So they set up called a doctrine of trust for Indians, which says, since we are a weak and powerless people, since we don't own and control anything, then since you all beat us and you've misused us and own us now, then you owe it to us to take care of us. You see, you said you owe it to us to take care of us, so they call it a doctrine of trust. So the Indians then created a doctrine of trust so the United States government would take care of them. And as a result of that, see, then they could get free land, free labor, free medical care, free education, free casinos, okay? Tax-exempt status and pay no taxes, okay? Now, here are my people over here talking about, we want, first of all, we want is equal opportunity. We don't want you to give us anything. We don't want a handout. All we want is equal opportunity. Okay, the first thing. Secondly, where Indians, then Indians, and then they said, we are powerful, strong people. We don't need anything. Where Indians said, we are weak, take care of us. Then over here, Indians then said, we don't want to mix with you all. We are a separate people. We want to stay to ourselves. What we want to do is declare ourselves a nation. We're going to declare ourselves a nation, and we're going to write our own constitution to take care of our own people. Now, go back over here to these ones that are being shampooed, see? What they want to say is, we want to be a part of your constitution. We want to move into y'all. You see? And they never once have they ever said that we're a nation. And so they're developing some kind of a constitution or a national plan or empowerment for ourselves like the Indians did. That's why I wrote this new book I got come out called Powernomics. That's what it's about. Say, for once in your life, quit being shampooed. Wake up and smell the coffee. So I wrote that one to say, now, like the Indians, we're going to be a separate nation. We're going to be a nation of people just like Indians are. And the way the Indians got it approved, that's after they set their constitution, they kept calling themselves a nation. And even though blacks in America are a nation within a nation, they've always been a nation within a nation. Black folk are just as segregated now as they were in 1954. You still not integrated anything. You're just as segregated now. You're still a nation within a nation. All they got to do is declare themselves a nation, get them a constitution, and that's what you're going to get in power now. And y'all make sure you buy that book when it comes out, okay? You're going to get that. Now, so they got that set up. Now, what we want to do then is, so the Indians then said, they kept playing around this thing about being a nation, being a sovereign nation. Called themselves a foreign nation because they had to deal with the federal government. Because the federal government was protecting the citizens. So then about 1832, a Supreme Court justice named John Marshall, he ruled and made it official. Because at that time, we had a do-gooder white liberal out messing around with the Indians on the reservations. And I think it was in Georgia, there was a law in Georgia that said, you know, they didn't want whites on the reservation stirring up the Indians. So the whites arrested him, put him in jail, something like this. He appealed, and they sent him to something like 15 years imprisonment. He then appealed and went to the Supreme Court. They got in the Supreme Court in 1832. Chief Justice Marshall ruled and said that the Indians are a separate nation. He picked up that rhetoric that the Indians have been pushing about being a separate nation. And then he said, well, the Indians are a separate nation, so therefore this guy's got a right to go out there when he wanted to. And when he made that ruling in 1832, that officially then made in our constitutional law, they started accepting Indians being a separate nation. Okay? Now they're a separate nation and with sovereignty, and now watch what happens now. Now they're getting dual benefit. They're getting reparations all the time. Now, Indians now, that means every state set up an Indian commission. Every state has a separate Indian commission now to give Indians what they want because they're under the doctrine of a trust, that they are dependent people and you have to take care of them, those on the reservation. And they're never going to lose the reservation because they're not stupid. Why would they leave the reservation? They sit there and be taken care of. And you always got people that look how poor they are. Yes, they're poor because they ain't going to leave theirs. They want you to bring it to them. They can leave anytime they want to. Any poverty the Indians got is poverty they sit there waiting with for you to come resolve for them. They don't have to stay on the reservation. They stay there because that's free land and free everything. So when they set up that kind of a trust, Indians then sat there and waited for it. But we didn't set up that kind of trust. And when they got that ruling, that made it legitimate then that Indians were now an official foreign nation. And then every state then set up an Indian commission that gives Indian services. Then they set up a federal Indian Bureau in Washington, D.C. The federal Indian Bureau typically puts out something like about $23,000 to $26,000 a year for every Indian in the United States. Then you got the biggest Indian tribe in the United States, the Cherokee tribe, that picks up in terms of reparations. They pick up something like about 155,000 Cherokee Indians out there to get $770 million a year in reparation funds. So Indians are getting all kinds of reparations. Indians have been getting reparations through treaties now, through land and free everything now for 200 and some years. Black folk have got nothing because you went the wrong way. You cannot sit there and want to be a part of white society and that's exactly what the game they want you to play. You'd rather say, no, I'm a separate nation. You have problems. You owe me just like you owe the Indians. Indians should be your model. And that's why Indians now can walk into all the cities and now set up special casinos. You only got 237 Indian reservations in the United States. And Indians now got 258 casinos in the United States. They've run out of reservations to even put casinos on. And typically those casinos bring in $1 million a day per casino. Not in revenue, not $1 million a day in revenue, $1 million a day in profits. So the Indians now took those funds as reparation funds, and now they are building, taking that money, and they're building economic structures for their people. They're building shopping malls and centers and all kinds of things, industries for their people, while we sit here looking for handouts through affirmative action that everybody else is giving away to everybody else but us. To even make it worse than that, we should be trying to be independent and arrogant, pretend that somehow we can compete with white folks with nothing. And we got these little watered down, useless, half a business ain't worth 2 cents. And we got something like about 500,000 black business in the United States. They only employ 1.5 people on average. And they always bragging about the number of black businesses have doubled in the last 20 years. Yes, the number of black businesses doubled, but the money didn't double. They ain't getting more money. You got more people chasing the same dollar. Okay, so first, our model then should be ideally be Indians. We can track them and do some of the same things they did, and that means that not only will we try to follow their policies of non-integration, but trying to be a separate people and getting them as much advantage as you possibly can. Secondly, under the doctrine of trust, make the government responsible, because we are just as weak. There's nobody is more weak than slaves. And see, the Indians were not enslaved, they were free. And yet they are now classified as weak people, so they're given all these benefits. That's why their kids can go to school and get free college education. That's why they got 28 universities in the country. So we then want to get some of those same identical benefits that Indians are getting. So when people start telling you every time black folk want to say, we need this and that, and they say, well, Dr. Anderson, black folk are not as bad off as the Indians. I say, if the Indians are that poor, make black folk like Indians. Treat us like Indians if they're that poor. See, but they always want to try to neutralize any concern you have about correcting conditions of black folk by pointing to Indians. And they point to those Indians who are sitting out here on the reservation, they're sitting there waiting for something. And so what I'm telling them, then let us be treated like that. Treat my people like Indians. Let us be tax exempt. Well, we don't pay any taxes every year. We play the same game they're playing, okay? Now, the next thing we want to do is we got to be prepared to start answering some of these people who are going to be opposed to reparations for black folk. They're going to come at you in three different ways. The first group that's going to come after you are going to be whites. You can rest assured right now that 99.1% of all white people in America are opposed to reparations for black folk. You must be ready to deal with that. Be ready to deal with it. Because they're going to be opposed to you for a very simple reason. That's called R-A-C-I-S-M, racism. Racism means maintain the conditions on black folk the way they always were. So they don't want you to change anything. So they're going to come after you. But keep in mind that whether or not white folks want reparations for black folk is immaterial. We could care less about what they think. That's not the issue. That's like, because in a system of justice, when it is not the perpetrator's responsibility to decide whether or not you're entitled to compensation. See, in other words, if you ran over my house right now and killed my dog or something, I sue you. You can't say, well, I killed your dog and tore up your house, but I'm against your suing me. That's immaterial to me. It is black folks' decision whether or not they want reparations and how they're going to get it. So, and they start telling about white folks oppose it, fine. I told you a few minutes ago, 99% of all the white people in America were opposed to freedom for black folk out of slavery. Keep that in mind. 99% were opposed to your being freed in 1860 at the eve of the Civil War. Also, during integration, you had about 87% of all the white people in America were opposed to integrating. So whether or not they want emancipation or not is immaterial. So be ready to deal with them. The second group you got to deal with are going to be black folk. You're going to have all kind of black folk in this country going to be opposed to reparation for you. They're going to be jumping out. They're going to be jumping out of the woodwork. They're going to be jumping out of woodwork because they're scared to death. They're just as scared now as they were in 1860. They're going to say, we don't have anything, and when we ask for something, they'll take away what we got, and we don't have anything, but they'll take nothing away from us. And so And you're going to have that group that's always scared, and they're always going to say it's better for us to have nothing than you try to get something, because that way they'll take us back to nothing, which is where we are already. So watch out for that group. They're going to be coming out. The other group you're going to come out against, you're going to be a lot of your black leadership in America. The black leadership are going to come out of the walls. Whites are going to pay a lot of blacks to come out against reparations for black folks. Okay? And I've already been told this by one of the biggest white law firms that I know, have already sat across the table from me and my staff, and Dr. Anson, we're going to help you all with reparations. These are Jews now. That we'll help you all with reparations, but the problem you got to watch out for is that you're going to have all kinds of blacks coming out against you. And I said, I doubt that. And they said, no. They said, I said, how do you know that? They said, we might be white, but we're not stupid. They said, we know there are blacks in America who are paid. They're paid to come out against you all on everything you want to do to get black folk out of the ditch. We know that. And if we're going to help you, you better be prepared to deal with that and give us some ways of dealing with it. And they're going to come after you a lot of ways. You're going to have a lot of blacks coming after you telling you the same thing like whites, that you don't need it, or that's counterproductive, or whites can get angry, or you're going to create racial problems in the country, anything else. See, it doesn't create a problem for anybody else to get something. Only when you all get something creates a problem. They're going to come out and tell you that, okay? And they're going to be paid to do it. And they're going to try to do it also by always blending it in, going back to those terms I told you about earlier. Anytime a black person comes out, start talking about all, we all, you all, poor folk, multicultural, culturally diverse, minorities, you all have been had and been shampooed, okay? That's what it means. Anytime you got a black elected official, or a black civil rights leader, or a black minister, he's going to represent all the people, you've been had. Your first concern is you take care of your own people first, okay? You have never heard a white person jump up and say he represents all the people. Come to Washington, watch all the white senators come across this country. They say, I come here to represent my constituency, my people, back in my home, in my city, in my state. Only black folk want to represent everybody. That goes back to that slavery bit I told you about earlier. Watch that. When they start talking about everyone and everybody, you're through in the country. So watch for them, and when they do it, you all nail them. Nail them up front. I don't care whether it's an elected official or a civil rights leader, but they're going to be coming out against us pretty soon, okay? The second thing you got to watch out for now, we got to be able to look for the responses of what it's going to come out with. They're going to come out with stuff like, why am I responsible for reparations for black folk? My family didn't enslave any black folk. Fine, that's good. But you still owe us. You owe us, first of all, because it doesn't make any difference whether or not your family enslaved black folk. You came here and enjoyed all the benefits of them enslaving black folk. And you're not paying for the fact that black folk were enslaved, whether your family enslaved them or who enslaved them. You're paying for the benefits that you enjoyed then and you enjoy now. You're just paying for benefits, okay? Amen. So you make sure you take it over to benefits. You tell me you ain't concerned about who did the enslaving. You're concerned about who's enjoying the benefits. And they're going to pay for it like any other person in the house. You go into a restaurant, they're going to pay. Whoever gets the service is the person that pays for it. You enjoyed all the benefits of coming into this country. You can't. Nobody begged you to come from Europe or from the Far East or from Latin America into this country. You came here because you wanted to enjoy all those benefits that black folk had created. You sat at the table in the banquet and you ate, now it's the bill time, okay? You're gonna run into some groups and be telling you stuff like, well, Dr. Anderson, why do black folk deserve reparations in the first place? I mean, look at Jesse Jackson, and look at Michael Jackson, and look at Michael Jordan, and look at Oprah. They got money. You got to understand that wealth and income is totally different. Do not let anybody try to put down black folk by pointing to a few blacks that got income. Those few blacks that got that kind of income, I can put in one cab in L.A. and take them any place I want them. You know? They do not represent black folk in America. You know, I'm talking about all the poor blacks, all these blacks that don't have anything in America. You understand what I'm saying? Right now in America, Hispanic or Mexican with a $3,000 a year income and can live as well as a black in America with a $40,000 income. As a matter of fact, if I take a white person with a $40,000 income between 40 and 50 and a black person between 40 and 50, what happens there, they're not equal. They might have the same income, but white folks have 3,500 times the wealth that a black person has. It is wealth in America that determines your opportunity, not income. Do not get confused with income. You see, all these so-called blacks in America, they keep talking about middle-class blacks. Blacks got into the middle class through income. Whites got into the middle class through wealth. There's a difference now. Wealth means, that means what's left over after you pay your bills. Most of the blacks in America, I can go around right now, they got high incomes. I ask them for $10, they got to figure out what bill they're not going to pay next year. Because they don't have any wealth behind them. And for the sisters again, let me tell you sisters that keep getting hung up on this gender issue and let's say your blackness. If I were to take that in terms of wealth, for instance, a white woman in America who heads a family, like they talk about a female-headed families, a white female is totally different from a black female. What a white female has to treat her family off of a white female-headed household is $1. For that, a black woman only has 3 cents for every $1 the white woman has to run a female-headed household. So don't get hung up on this income business. Go for the wealth. And so we start talking about wealth. Tell white folks, and the white folks say, well, Dr. Anderson, what about the fact that reparations will set an ideological precedence that'll be bad for the country? That's BS. See, let me go back again in history again. I told you earlier, go back to history. Everybody in America has gotten reparations for black folks. Now, let's go back to the earliest form of reparations. Indentured white servants got reparations. Every white person that came to America as a white indentured servant, he signed a contract for 5 to 7 years. And at the end of that 5 to 7 years, he got animals, land. It was called freedom of dues. He got freedom dues was land, animals, money, weapons, tools, and clothes. That was called freedom dues for white indentured servants. Now, all the other whites in America, in the South particularly, got reparations after the end of the Civil War. I just talked to you. Let me go back. I'm going to refer back so you remember this stuff now. At the end of the Civil War, when I told you that they had all that land and all that prosperity in the South, they could have distributed it to black folk. They chose instead through the Freedmen's Bureau to give all that land, all that resources to whites. They wanted to rebuild the South. The government, the Northern Union, put all that money into redeveloping the South and gave it to whites and back to the plantation owners. So white people all got reparations again for that. Also in Washington, D.C., Lincoln passed through this bill to give every white person $300 for freeing his slave. He got reparations. Now, Indians have gotten reparations. Now let's go to the Jews. Following World War II, Jews now, since World War II, have picked up over $52 billion in reparations just from Germany for what they did to them, for enslaving them. I told you earlier when Roosevelt was talking to Hitler about using free Jewish labor, then the Jews now got compensated for that, for what Hitler did to them. They picked up $52 billion just since the end of World War II. In addition to that, we went over there and bombed Japan and fought a war with Japan, and even black folks participated, helped in the fight. And as soon as the war was over, the United States turned around under the Point 4 plan and gave Japan over $13 billion to rebuild. And they just finished a war with them. They went to Europe, and they put out another $13 to $14 billion under the Marshall Plan to rebuild Germany. The blacks to fault. Now, with the Japanese, came to this country, in this country, they were interment, which means in Los Angeles and around this area. They were not enslaved. They were not Jim Crow. They were not lynched and castrated. They were just simply relocated for the safety of the country. And the Japanese have picked up 3 forms of reparations already. Each, for 2 of them from the federal government, ran $1 billion each, giving them $20,000 for every adult. So they've gotten reparations. Everybody's gotten reparations but black folk. So you tell them, no, that you're entitled to reparations. Now, another thing they'll tell you, they'll say, Dr. Anderson, I'm just a single person trying to earn a living. Why should I pitch in and pay for black reparations? I don't have any money, and I haven't done anything to black folk. Get them this way. You tell them this, that black folk, just like everybody else in the society, in a social democracy, have an obligation to the whole. Black folk did not take Indians' land. But we've been taking care of Indians as black folk ever since we came to this country. Okay? All that money going into those Indian treaties and going to Indians, those federal Indian bureaus and state Indian commission and paying for Indians so Indians can't pay taxes and giving reparations to Indians. Black folk are paying for that. Black folk did not create World War I and World War II, but black folk fought and put money into it. Black folk did not steal $750 billion out of the SNLs in the United States. But every black adult in the country has to put in $2,000 for 20 years to repay it. Black folk have not done any of the things in this country, but black folk are charged with everything that goes down. And so whites must understand that everything that went wrong with black folk, they got an obligation to correct it. Just if they're white, fine, you still pay it. There are no longer. Whites must understand that the days of the thrill are gone. Now, to get the thrill, you got to get the bill. Oh. Now, as we get our money, we got to move our resources into several things. We start developing it. When we get these funds, keep in mind, no black person should be looking for money individually. We're not going to get into that bag. No black money comes except those who are going to be a part of some of our national suits. Any black that becomes a part of our national suit, you can get money directly. We'll be having hearings through the Harvest Institute in Washington, Detroit, and Los Angeles, where we'll be taking testimony, making blacks a part of a national suit, because we're going to be going after about 257 white corporations, okay? Now, if we win that, you get money. The rest of you blacks don't get any money that way. The way you get your money, the money's going to go into special funds in the country between two regional development banks on both sides of the country. And what we do then, black folk can go to those banks and borrow that money either to get long-term, low-interest loans of no more than about 1% interest rate, or the money would go in to help you start a business as equity capital so you don't have any debt, okay? Two, the other thing you get, the other thing we do, we take that money and use a lot of that money to set up a special fund also to go back and recapture our black colleges and bring them back home so they can take care of their original business, okay? Three, we're going to try to take our money to go back and rebuild our black communities and try to put it for the infrastructure, repairs them and improvements of the looks of them. And also we're going to try to take that money for black communities and build factories across America. There are industries we can take and build businesses to be competitive. We're also going to take our power that comes with that and try to set up special exempt status for black folk in some of these ghetto areas. We got ghetto lands. Those lands should be redistributed to black folk. You got a lot of state-owned land, federal land, and ghetto land, and abandoned land in these black cities that don't belong to anybody. We want a land redistribution program. Black folk were never involved in the Homestead Acts in this country, all that land with the white folks. We want to get our land act together so we can get some land. And also what we want to do is to be able to help black folk. We want to also take some of that money that comes to us. We want to set up a special kind of organization like the Harvest Institute. It may even be the Harvest Institute that will go around this country and act just like the Jewish Committee, the National Committee of Jews, which says we will watch and monitor exactly who's coming after black folk and bothering black folk so we can protect black folk. But I can go on and on to tell you, you know, all the things we're going to do, but Harvest Institute right now is about the only think tank you got, the only thing that represents black folk in this country. We don't mind being black, even though all of our black entertainers and black athletes and Dr. Anson, what's the Harvest Institute for? I said, it's black folk. This is what it do. I said, help black folk. It's who's running. We said, black folk. They said, ooh, too black. I don't know how anything gets to be too black when nothing is too Indian, too Jewish, you know, or too white. You see, all white people in America got their own communities, their own churches, their own business, and their own schools, and nobody ever says something is too white. But the minute you try to help black folk, it's too bad or too black. And so we're going to deal with all those too blacks too, okay? But the last thing I want to tell you about this is that we're going to come together as a group. We need your support in this country. And it's a new day for black folk. We're going to go after reparations, no more affirmative action. We're going to go as a team. Whether you like it or not, God has arbitrarily assigned you to a skin color team. And regardless of how much money you got, I love you, but regardless of how much money you got, it doesn't make any difference. How much education you got, it doesn't make any difference. Because if your team loses, everybody on that team is going to lose and go down with it. And you got to operate as a team. Everybody else operates as a team because why? Because racism is a team sport. Remember that. Racism is a team sport. You cannot get in the game playing as an individual. You can only play as a group. I want you all to stay together as a group, and we can make it as a team. And a person tried to point this out. Our dilemma and our problem back in 1840s, it was Harriet Tubman. When she came up north, they tried to give her a reward, a citation for having fought for black folk. She stood up before the audience, and they said, look, Mrs. Tubman, you've done a magnificent job. You've gone all over this country for years, bringing back hundreds of black folk to the north, to the promised land. And how do you feel about that, all those trips into the dangerous south to bring back blacks to the hundreds of blacks to the north? She said, I could have brought back thousands of those Negroes that don't know they were slaves. And the same thing was picked up. We got all these blacks in the country that don't know that they're in trouble. And this point was picked up again by G. Carter Woodson in 1933 when they asked him, said, what's the future of the black race? You know, why can't black folk get out of this dilemma, out of this problem? He says it's almost impossible to get blacks out and save black folk when all those blacks who are in responsible positions that should know better keep doing everything they do can take black folks backwards. Okay? So what I'm saying to you, we love you. We're going to come together as a team. We're going to do it. And we're going to do it first through reparations. And the Harvest Institute will be conducting these hearings all over the country. I want you to come forward and try to help us. But more importantly, we cannot do it if we don't have the money. If we don't raise enough money, we can't do it. Now, that puts a special burden on you all in Los Angeles because you all are about the strongest, most aggressive, most sensitive, committed blacks we got in the country. You all got to figure out how to raise money for the Harvest Institute and do it fast so we can have those hearings. And what those hearings are going to do is collect all that data and information. We're going to store it. Then we're going to analyze it, all the tapes, everybody who comes forward and say, my mother lost the land here, they killed my daddy doing this, whatever it is. We're going to have all those records in one place. Then we're going to go through that, and we're going to sift out the information and come up with the legal justification and the financial justifications so we can go forward with legal action all over America to try to get reparations for black folk that might equate to about $500 billion, okay? So we're going to do it. But you all got to help us do it. Without you, it won't happen. I could spend much more time telling you about the things we have to do in reparations, but more important, remember one thing. Reparations means making whole, bringing to a good, productive condition. When you're repairing something, that's what we're after in reparations. I love all of you, and take care. Thank you. I love all of y'all now.
Not surprised, you take a decided historical tone with this book, but what's interesting about the way this book is put together, Dr. Anderson, is that it includes myriad factoids about history, black, white, and otherwise. But in addition to that, you are trying to set a record straight, a record full of holes, voids, and obvious omissions. You say that black history is not, or history in general, is not taught very well in the American public education system. How would you change the way it's taught?
The first thing I would do is go, I would have to base it on what I learned years ago when I was over education for the state of Florida. Being over the state, over the education system, I went in and reviewed some of the textbooks, Daryl. I found out in the state of Florida that invariably blacks only showed up twice in the history books. Either showed up in the course of slavery, where they were either picking cotton in the fields, or secondly, they showed up in the civil rights movement, where they were demonstrating or rioting. And I tried to insist in the state of Florida that they put some blacks into the history book that really told the true story about black folk. And the book companies told me, the publishing company said, well, Dr. Anderson, we can't do that. There's nothing about blacks. We don't have any accomplishments of black folk. That was the first thing that set me off. That was a alarm bell off my head. That somebody is not teaching it. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the white kids in the state of Florida, as well as the black kids, are being deprived of a true understanding of black folks' role in history. The second thing I found out, Daryl, was that in going into the black schools, invariably during the month of February, they call that Black History Month, and almost every school in the United States will have up the same 10 or 15 pictures on the wall of various individuals. And I would ask you right now to name those 10 or 15 individuals. You can do it very easily. And what they are doing is teaching our black kids that is black history. That's not black history either. Nobody ever talks about the major contributions that black folk have made. Not those well-known personalities, but the millions and millions of cotton pickers and ditch diggers and dishwashers and janitors. Those are the people who made the substantive contributions in this country. I want to make sure those people are put into the textbook. That's how America acquired its wealth. That's how it's maintained its wealth. And that's why blacks have also been subordinated in the society.
Indeed, you have gone that extra mile to talk about lots of different people in American history whose exploits are not limited to America, mm-hmm. whose exploits are not limited to the black community. And in fact, you start off the book, one of the earliest characters you talk about is a young man whose exploits carried him into, through, or at least around Spain. You talk about Juan Latino and the American capital tax. What's the connection?
The American capital, he was about the last individual in Spain before the Jacinto policy went into effect, where officially black folk were identified as being the slave class, the laboring class of the world. And he was the last one going through college at that time. He was the last one to get a degree, the professional group. But at that same time, they passed in Spain a tax saying that any black person that had a degree, just not because of his education, but because he was black, had to pay a tax. And this country, excuse me, had the same thing, Darryl. In the all during slavery, it was called a capital tax.
Mm-hmm.
That same tax that was started in Spain carried forth through the slavery process in this country, which meant a black person, a black man, had to pay a tax. And usually it averaged about $15, not because of anything else, just merely on the fact that he was black. And what that money was used for was to subsidize schooling for whites
mm-hmm.
and all kind of institutional programs for whites that black folk could not penetrate, were not included in. So in the society, throughout our society, whether it was in Spain or through America, black people have always had a black, paid a black tax just for the mere fact of their presence.
Another fact that you point out in the book talks about national holiday that will be coming up soon in our country, known as Thanksgiving. You say Thanksgiving may well have its roots in the black struggle.
Right, I think it did. Thanksgiving initially was a celebration by Indians in the fall, but it never was called Thanksgiving. The first time it was called Thanksgiving was in 1863 when President Lincoln declared it to be a day of Thanksgiving. But at the same time he put out the Day of Thanksgiving, he also put out the Emancipation Proclamation that freed black folk. And those two were interrelated in giving thanks, and their celebration almost ran together. And so, but whenever people talk about Thanksgiving, they do not relate the fact that throughout history, nobody ever had a Thanksgiving until he put out the proclamation, Emancipation Proclamation,
mm-hmm.
in that year, and gave a national impetus to looking out for those people who were being freed and were thankful to God and to country. So there's a nationalism attached to Thanksgiving that reflected right over on the black people in this society.
And in fact, because of the Emancipation Proclamation, the event set in motion by the fates of war as well as
yes.
the struggle between the North and South over slavery, you also illuminate a lot of the mystique, the myth, as well as the fact around one Mr. Abraham Lincoln and what his true motivations were concerning to free or not to free enslaved Africans. Talk a little bit about what happens in this book in terms of what you disclose there. Did Abraham Lincoln really want to free slaves?
No. His primary thing was try to maintain the Union. And that was the first thing. And secondly, in maintaining the Union, he wanted to help the North to redistribute the wealth out of the South. The wealth was pretty well contained in the South. And the North wanted to industrialize because, see, England already had its industrial revolution, and the Northerners were repressing the president to try to relocate the wealth to the North so they can have an industrial revolution in this country. And secondly, they wanted to be able to put the Northern immigrants into the country, white immigrants coming to this country, into a position where they can make an income. See, in other words, the salary level was so low in the North, you can't work in a cheaper than free, so you had to get rid of slavery. But slavery was incidental to the fact they wanted to relocate the wealth and not divide the Union. Lincoln never really expressed any positive feelings about black folk. His primary emphasis was that he wanted to be able to redistribute the wealth, and he was willing also to ship blacks out of the country. He came up with a couple of programs to relocate blacks either to Latin America or Central America or back to Africa.
You even quote former president as having gotten a laugh at a speech that he gave when following the murder of an abolitionist, he joked that we have abolitionists where we come from too. In fact, we shot one the other day.
That's right. And he did some similar things too. As a matter of fact, he even sent a memorandum request over to the Congress to have Congress to appropriate funds to reimburse all the Southern white slaveholders for any loss, you know, and even if they were to lose that slavery with the relocation of the wealth in this country. He wanted to compensate them for reparations. And the Congress sent a letter back to him saying, we appreciate your interest in the South, but we don't even have that kind of money. You got almost 5 million black folk in this country. We've already invested over $8 billion into them. That is the largest amount of money and concentration of money in this country. The money invested in black slaves was larger than all the businesses in the United States and the federal government's budget put together. So Congress said, we don't have that kind of money. But Lincoln wanted to give reparations to Southern white plantations owners for any slaves they lost.
But in 1998, when blacks talk about reparations for free labor in slavery, they are virtually laughed to scorn. Why is that?
That's part of the hypocrisy in this country because first thing, black folk have never made it an issue. They keep thinking that they won't get it. Black people, only group of people I know in this country who've labored and suffered and never got compensated for it. We've compensated American Indians now for almost 360 years with reparations. Whites got reparations, which they call freedom dues, and they came out of indentured servitude. Jews have gotten reparations. Jews have picked up over $52 billion since World War II. Japanese have gotten three or four reparations. They got $22,000 each starting in 1990 from the United States. They've also gotten reparations from two cities in California and the state of California. And they've got Japanese Americans who moved to Latin America just came back into the country last year and picked up over $1 billion. The only people who've never gotten compensated is black folk. We even put money into Japan under what we call the Point 4 program, gave them $13 billion after we just got through bombing them. We also put another $14 billion into the Marshall Plan for Germans after we just finished bombing them. Black folks have never been compensated because black folks refuse to make reparations an issue.
You also talk, since we're on this subject, we'll stay here just for a second before we go to break, talking about reparations, talking about the Germans, talking about what happened to Jews during the Holocaust. You mention in Dirty Little Secrets the fact that there were black Germans. In fact, there was a black German in particular by the name of Larry who lived in the town of Dusseldorf,
mm-hmm.
Along with many other blacks who lived in Germany who became prisoners in concentration camps who were forced to do the slave-type labor in those camps. However, the fact that they were being exterminated is a historic fact that has been vastly overlooked.
That's right. As a matter of fact, after World War I, there were a lot of black immigrants that came out of Africa that went to Germany. Also, the German recruited a lot of the Africans into some of their lower levels of their military. And so we had a lot of blacks living in Germany even before the Holocaust began. And they were the first to go, the first to be exterminated. But you notice how skillfully that has never been brought out, that all those blacks have been a part of the Holocaust and the execution of people in Germany. And yet when the compensation rewards were given out, not only were blacks not mentioned, but blacks had never gotten one penny of reparations out of the Holocaust in the 1930s.
Some would say that the link perhaps between those people and their survivors, and in fact if there were any black survivors, which of course from your writing seems doubtful,
mm-hmm.
Could not be established, and therefore reparations can't be paid.
Well, that's the same technique as you. That's why they refuse to pay blacks for slavery. They want to pretend that slavery ended in 1865. Slavery didn't end in 1865. Slavery became semi-slavery, what we call Jim Crow semi-slavery, right up until 1968, and all those people are still alive.
When you talk about Jim Crowism, your book talks about the roots of Jim Crowism, symbolically at least. You talk about how the whole concept of Jim Crow was actually born out of the old minstrel show concept.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that before we go to break.
Well, it came out. As a matter of fact, there's one guy who was an entertainer. He saw a little black kid one day jumping around on the street doing a dance called Jump Jim Crow, Jump Around, Skip Around, Jump Jim Crow. And he thought it was very cute, and he put it into the vaudeville act. And between about 1840s and up until about the 1930s, for almost 100 years, vaudeville was very popular in this country. But what they were doing was blackfacing and doing blackface, whites doing blackface comedy, trying to mimic black folks. They did it all the way up until Al Jolson about the last one that did it, and on stage. Then after that, you had Amos and Andy picked it up, and that carried forth all the way up to the present day, where you got white musicians singing black music. And as a matter of fact, back in the 1960s, there was one very popular manager, a guy they call the King of Rock and Roll, who said, if you can find me a white man that can sing like an Indian, I'll make him a millionaire. And so now what you have is all these white artists are now trying to imitate black folks, still doing the blackface makeup. You can find everything like most of your British singers all try to imitate, from the Bee Gees all the way up to Elton John to Michael Bolton. All of them are imitating black folks.
At least in the case of the British, they admit that they are copying the black music style.
Yes. As a matter of fact, almost every singer is copying black folk because whites don't have any music. The only true art form in America is black music. And sadly, that's about a $150 billion a year industry, and black folk get less than 1%. But unfortunately, that's part of our fault, because right now down in a city in Texas right now, they are recruiting black blues singers to come in and to teach white boys how to sing blues. They're going to call Blues Alley. They got a whole street they're building where they're going to have black folk to come in and teach white boys to play black music and sing black, and so they can make money off it. And you got blacks that go out and do it.
Thank you. Yeah. One of the things you've done in Dirty Little Secrets is you seem to have unearthed or decloaked a lot of the personality around the people that we've read about in history, and you've made them real. You fleshed them out, as it were, and so we have stories behind the history. To a very large degree, we see that in the character of the person we were discussing a few seconds ago, Phyllis Wheatley. Phyllis Wheatley thought that she could matriculate through American society as someone who could travel unimpeded because of her exceptional talent. She was a poet, a writer, a black woman who had received education in Europe and was going before the crown heads of Europe who were thrilled with her presence, but something else happened after she got there, didn't it?
Yes, she did. As a matter of fact, before she left, she had been received by the President of the United States, George Washington, at that time, and they had all lauded her skills as a poet. And she never wanted to include anything about blackness, about being black, about black issues or black concerns in any of her writings, even though we hold her up in high honor and esteem today. But when she got to England, she ran into the racial realities. First of all, she ran into it because a book she received from one of the heads there, it was bound in black skin, actual black skin.
Black human skin.
Black human skin bound, had been used to bind one of her books. And that shocked her to death. And secondly, she went and married a black man. And once she married a black man, she became face-to-face with the realities of being black in America. And after that, she went downhill. They went into poverty and in bad health, and she died poor and poverty-stricken.
You talk about Frederick Douglass, someone who is known for his intellect, his great writing ability, and his abolitionist stance. However, Frederick Douglass paled in comparison as a leader in the freedom struggle when you talk about a white man like John Brown. Why is that?
Well, because John Brown wanted to raid Harper's Ferry to try to free the black slaves in this country.
And again, John Brown was white.
John Brown was white.
And felt he had a duty given to him from God to which he dedicated his wife, his children, and all his resources.
Yes, sir. And what he said is that if I can go into Harper's Ferry and take that armory and get enough weapons and free the blacks, he said I can use that as like use those mountains like a stake and drive it into the heart of racism in America. If I can free enough of those blacks and arm them and send them into those hills, nobody could ever bring them back. I can break the back of racism in America. But what he needed, he said, but for me to do it successfully, I must have a high visible black person who would come with me and call the blacks out. They're not going to come out for me. They come out. I must have a black that they have trust in and confidence in. They must call them out. The two most visible blacks in the United States at that time was Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman. And so John Brown met and asked Frederick Douglass. Well, first he asked Harriet Tubman, but Harriet Tubman was sick and she couldn't come. Mm-hmm. And he asked Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass met with him for a whole week. They went off and discussed it. And he said, you got to come with me and call the blacks out. And Frederick Douglass said to him, so let's be straight on one thing, John Brown. He says, I'm always ready to fight for black folk. And John Brown says, look, I'm a white man, but I'm ready to die for him. Would you ready to do that? And in that light, Frederick Douglass willed it. And on his deathbed, he confessed that he was scared to death.
The reason that he didn't go to the Harper's Ferry raid was because he was scared to lose his life.
He was scared to lose his life. So John Brown went on his own and held that and took the armory and held that city at bay for a day and a half. And I think about 52 blacks did escape. But he paid the high penalty. But he said that was his calling from God. And if he had had a black to call those black folk out of slavery, the slavery would have been broken in 1859.
One of the other secrets you unearth that perhaps a lot of folk don't know about America proper and blacks is that there were quite a few black slaveholders and land barons during our enslavement period. Talk about that.
Well, just like Phyllis Wheatley, we have a lot of blacks who've always thought that they can be the exceptional black, and that therefore the whites will pull them to their breasts and say, this is an exceptional black, and he's different from the rest of them, and therefore he can be excluded from racism. And we have them today, right now, on all of our TV shows. We got them in the media. We got them in sports that always feel that somehow they're an exception. And even back when I was a kid, Joe Louis was an exceptional black during the 1940s. But whites hated the rest of the black folk. They were still lynching one black person a day when Joe Louis was the heavyweight champion of the world. Well, that was also true in slavery. In slavery, we had one guy named William Johnson, for instance. William Johnson had an education. He was a teacher. But he turned around and wrote and published a document that was spread all over this country by the white racists and white slaveholders, telling black folk to be obedient, to be humble, to work, be hardworking, and quit trying to be free, and quit letting liberals trick them, trying to get stop following the abolitionists who's trying to get them out of slavery. He said the best thing you got going for you is to be a slave to a white man. We had one guy named Robert DeCarlos. He was the first one down in South Carolina. As soon as black folk came out of slavery, he got elected to office. And the first thing he said is, in South Carolina, now that we're the majority and we're free, our first obligation is a time for healing. We got to be nice to whites. We cannot use our power and wealth now as the dominant population in South Carolina and in the Congress to do anything to white folks. We cannot be asking them for reparations. So he posted a bill to make sure that the 40 acres of mule never came off in that state, and that the entire state was much kinder and had a much better feeling about the dominant white society. But within 3 years of that, white society wrote the black codes and re-enslaved all those blacks, including him.
You talk about early American history and the events that have shaped the character of myth, lore, and fact as it relates to things as well-known as the Salem witch trials and the witch hunts.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned in this book, Dirty Little Secrets, that they may have started with an emphasis on black females.
Yes, it did. That started pretty much, the Salem witch hunt started about blacks. At that time, you had one black named Tubala. She was in that area, and she was a West Indian black, and she had been teaching two or three white girls about about black magic and stuff like this, and how to, and the conjure roots and the high John the Conqueror and root dust and stuff like this, and teaching them. And they started acting a little weird and did some things that were not acceptable in the community, and then they went out and told the community that the reason they were doing it was because of her. And so they prosecuted her, and then they got another woman named Black Mary. They got her and prosecuted her. But in the long run, they began to pick up black females all over the country because they thought most of them were practicing black magic. And so the first witches that were prosecuted in the United States were black women.
The book is filled with fascinating facts like that. I just want to move quickly through the material because we don't have a lot of time left, and I want to cover some of the categories you deal with. When we talk about politics, you attempt to draw the line of demarcation between what is commonly known in this country as the Uncle Tom syndrome and Samboism. What's the difference?
The difference is that people have misunderstood the book by Harriet Beecher Stowe about Uncle Tom's Cabin. Mm-hmm. It was not, Uncle Tom was not the culprit in that book. It was, the culprit was Sambo. See, Uncle Tom in that book, yes, he was a slave. He was extremely righteous and very religious man. But he was very respectful of the white leader, the slave owner. But he refused to misuse black folk. He refused to tell where black folk were hiding when they escaped the slavery and went across the river. He refused to make black folk work long hours and accelerate their cotton picking. And as a matter of fact, when blacks would come in the evening in that book, Uncle Tom would take cotton out of his own sack and put it in their sack to make sure they made the weight limit so they wouldn't be whipped. The character was Sambo. Sambo was that character who picked up meritorious manumission, which says, I would see everything through a white person's eye, and I would treat them the way a white person would treat them. So he volunteered to tell Simon Legree, I'll show you where the coons hide. I'll show you how to treat the niggas. And that's what he did. So he went off every night, and he was forced to beat Uncle Tom to finally beat Uncle Tom to death. So in America, we still got black folk in America who are trying to see things through the eyes of Simon Legree, which means trying to protect white property, to save white lives, to invent something that a white person can make more money off of, and to squeal on and inform on his own people. And Sambo is that same kind of character, and it showed up also when John Brown's raid that night. Mm-hmm. The black guy that was sitting on the porch that night, when he saw John Brown come into Harper's Ferry, mm-hmm. he jumped off the porch because he recognized John Brown and ran down the street, and John Brown killed him. And his name was Hayward Shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
And Hayward Shepherd has been immortalized. He's the only black in America where we have a Sambo monument to him, still in Washington, D.C. It's up at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. You go up there any time and see that, and it tells you exactly the kind of personality that the whites want in this country. That's a Sambo monument.
And you have a photograph of that monument slab in the book.
Yes, I do, because that's the only one left. As a matter of fact, they had it covered up until recent times. When I wrote that first book, Black Labor, White Wealth,
mm-hmm.
there was such a flood of people go up there looking for that monument, they finally had to take the cover off of it. They had pushed it beside the hotel across the street when John Brown was killed and captured. And so they pulled the cover off of it, and now it's out in the open.
You raised two very interesting questions regarding the role of the black female and her sexuality in American history. Number one, you asked the question, and I'm not sure whether it was rhetorically or analytically, but one, were females generally taken against their will by white slaveholders? And two, did black women indulge with white men for power and material benefits? And you ask these questions in the context of the liaison between white slave owners and black females with whom they had thousands of children. They were used for breeders. They were used as objects. They were used for their slave labor, but they were also used for sexual favor. And then you say, with these questions, were women, black women in particular, somehow complicit in all of this? What's the emphasis or the basis for raising those questions?
Two, I think primarily that they were taken initially against their will, and they were used as sexual objects, and they were, and most of them were reduced to being almost a prostitute or a mistress, because the white male wanted to save the sanctity of the white woman, and he wanted to treat her like precious china, and he put up her on a shelf to protect her. But the black female was exposed because the black man was out there to protect her. So they did use her, and they sexually abused the black female. But by the same token, there were a lot of black females, though, who found out that by being a mistress of a white man, that they had certain kind of advantages they were entitled to, and that in many instances their children could go into an artisan class or be called mulattoes and could be set free. And so the black female had it both ways. She was sometimes she would volunteer to get in that kind of relationship, and other times she was just simply taken.
Dr. Anderson, there are so many other fascinating details, facts, and historic truths in this book that I'd love to discuss, but we've got to stop right here.
Thank you very much, Eric, for inviting me in.
Thank you for coming and joining us on this edition of The Journal.
White wealth and other materials have made him a standby on many television and radio shows, as well as important symposiums and conferences on the issues of economic empowerment for the descendants of Africans in the United States of America and throughout the world. Whenever there's an important national convention or convening of people to talk about this subject, I never fail to find him on the program and enjoy him immensely. We welcome now Dr. Claude Anderson.
Thank you very much. And to my colleagues, let me say good afternoon to you and plus the members of the audience. According to John's letter, he indicated to me that he wants me to speak to develop a national plan, and John, that's what I'll try to do for you very quickly. But let me preface that by simply saying that if you hear about reparations, get this very firmly fixed in your mind. You're not here for a parlor discussion. It's not something to talk about that's nice. If you don't get reparations, black folk, you're through in this country. Let me be that very specific for you. You see, what's happening to black Americans is that black Americans have been systematically socially engineered into the lowest level of a real-life monopoly game. You do not own and control a sufficient amount of anything to be competitive in America. And you've been marginalized now for 400 years. You're getting ready to be buried. You can get buried under at least a whole broad groups of ambiguous groupings. That's everything from culture groups, language groups, and gender groups. You're going down. It's no longer an issue. You better get reparations and get it fast. Now, to get reparations, one of the things I've been trying to do now for 30 years, beginning with the state of Florida when Governor Reuben Askew put me over education when they had no blacks in politics in Florida, was to write the first affirmative action plan in the United States, and that was written to be reparations for black folk in 1971. And George Bush Jr., Jed Bush just killed it off about 6 months ago. But what's happening now is that what I'm trying to do is create a Harvest Institute that would try to take all my colleagues here and as much as possible try to give you new points of information that take you outside the box. Part of the problem we got in trying to deal with reparations, a lot of the other racial issues in the country, is that we keep trying to think and find solutions inside the box. There are no solutions inside the box for black folk. You got to get outside and try to find them and get a long-term perspective and a long view on it. And that's what the Harvest Institute is in existence for, and that's what they're going to stay in existence for. Now, the reason you cannot win, as I said,
is that you've been locked into this low level of a real life monopoly game. You do not own and control enough of wealth. See, in 1860, for instance, black folk, as a direct result of slavery, had an ownership. When you were 98% slaves, you had an ownership of one-half of 1% of this nation's wealth in 1860 on the eve of the Civil War. Now, this is the richest country in the world, the most capitalistic country in the world. And here you are 140 years after slavery when you're supposedly 100% free and you still only have one-half of 1% of this nation's wealth. You cannot compete. The typical average white person in America has 3,500 times more money than you have. And that's not true only of blacks in America. It's true of the world internationally. What's happening right now is blacks is a marginalized, subordinated class of people all over the earth. You have one-half of 1% of wealth in this nation. The same thing is true all over the world. In the world, there's approximately $392 trillion worth of wealth on the earth. And black folk around the world have less than 1% ownership of it. That includes all the African countries. That includes Brazil, Caribbean, and America. You don't own enough control of anything. Whites control almost 100% of all the wealth, power, resources, privileges, and controls of all levels of government. You're playing a game you can't win. You got to get reparations. Now, how are you going to get it? Let me give you a run through of three or four things very quickly because I don't want to take up the time here. First thing you must do, I've heard it mentioned already, we got to commit a national campaign all over this country to start publicizing the issue of reparations for black folk. Not as something nice, but as a necessity, period. That means every living soul, every organization, every core, every institution in this country must begin to start promoting reparations for black folk all over this country. That's level one, is a massive, massive promotion of reparations for black folk. Second level, level two, what we must do at second level two now is to start having fact-finding hearings. You must have fact-finding hearings all over this country. And you're going to have fact-finding hearings on at least two different levels. One is you're going to go after fact-finding about what roles governments have played in the reparations, in the slavery trade against black folk and the enslavement of black folk, the marginalization of black folk. And that should break down into two levels. One is to investigate all levels of domestic governments, that's city, county, federal, and state governments. And the second group would go after the international. So you should have two groups of black folk in this country exploring and fact-finding on what roles government have played, one domestically and one internationally. On the left-hand side, you should be doing the same thing for the domestic side. You should be going after the private sector. You should be going after all the private corporations in the United States, what roles they played and how they benefited directly from slavery. And also, on the same side, you must go after all the international corporations and the roles they played and how they benefited. Now, the Harvest Institute right now, my think tank, we've already picked up one. We put out a press release on that. We're going after domestic role that major corporations played in the United States. We've already identified approximately 240 companies that are still in existence that profiteer directly and enrich themselves off of black folk. We're going after that. And what we have to do in our fact finding is be able to factuate, document the direct line between how blacks have been crippled all the way up to economically, politically, socially, and educationally, and tied into these major corporations or tied into levels of government. That's your level two. Level three, you must then start having a national convention in this country. And right now, I think Dorothy Tillman in Chicago has already, we talked about this. She's going to try to call one in Chicago this coming year. We must have everybody who's playing a role, like Congressman Conyers and everybody from the Congress and COBRA, everybody should be at a national convention where we all come in there to not only energize each other, but to share information, see where we are. They're trying to set that up for this coming February, someplace in the United States, possibly Chicago. That's your third level. The fourth level you should start doing is out of this conference should come strategies and plans and a specific role model. You got to have a model that every black can tie into, a model for reparations. Now, my model is a little different from everyone else's, and that's because I'm outside the box. I'm trying to pull everybody else outside if I can get them. Now, most people are going to try to follow the Jewish reparations model or the Japanese model. I'm following the Indian model. The Indians are the most appropriate model if you want to track down doing anything to get reparations of black folk. Why? Because, you see, only American Indians and black folk were spelled out in the Constitution. The Indians own reservations and black folk. There's a direct lineage between those two groups. And if you really want to track and get reparations, the easiest and quickest way is to go find out what happened to American Indians, what benefits they got, and track it. In my new book called Power Numbers, it takes you through every one of those steps so you can follow it. If you pick that up, you can come right to reparations very quickly because it would be very difficult for the government to deny black folk the same thing they're giving the Indians. So when you hear people talking about how bad off Indians are, first thing you say, fine, if Indians are that bad off, put us as black folk in the same status with the Indians. We'll take that. Because see, right, what Indians got, See, first of all, nobody declared Indians to be a nation. Indians declared themselves to be a nation. They declared themselves to be a nation all the way up until about 1832 when Supreme Court Justice Marshall said, okay, I'll recognize you as a nation. We never declared ourselves to be a nation. We've always tried to do just the opposite of what the Indians did. Once they became a nation, they drew up a constitution for themselves. We never had a constitution. And what the Indians did with that constitution is then to go to the United States government and say, we do not want to integrate. We did just the opposite. We integrated. And I can track everything right down, or we can follow the Indian model if you want to. And you can see, and all that's already built into the law, and there's a direct lineage between American Indians and black folk that you can follow very easily and get to reparations. But we need to have a model. And in my new book, I get that model. It'll be on the stand in about another month. You get the Powernomics model that takes you through all those steps of what they did throughout history, from the Blair Amendments and everything else. You can track them very easily, and it'd be very difficult for the United States government to deny you reparations when you only two people that have a constitutional relationship with this government is black folk and Indians. Just like Indians use what they call natural rights and lay a claim against the land, we should use natural law and lay a claim against our labor, misappropriated labor. The next level what you must do is move to a legal step. You need to form at the fourth level, get you a legal body right now, whether it's going to be pro bono or paid. And out of our convention, we should be able to raise some funds to set up a mass legal body that will be ready to start serving suits based on those facts that you're going to find at the second level. And we start to find those, and we should have people going after suits, one side suing the different levels of government, other side suing the private sector to get reparation funds for black folk. Then at the last level, you can need to set up, at the sixth level, you need to set up some kind of a pool, a resource, a retrieval agency, every time we get some benefits, we're going to a special fund that will be held for pooling and aggregating. Now, then out of that special agency, we break away into two groups, what I would recommend. One, you would have an economic development bank on the East Coast and an economic development bank on the West Coast. And what those banks would do is take most of the money you get, not give it to black folk as individuals. You put it into a massive bank where black folk can go draw that money to start low interest, get low interest loans or free money to build businesses and industries throughout the United States. You also, if you track the Indians, you should try to get yourself some tax-exempt land. Just like Indians can go grab any piece of land and federalize and put up a casino, you tell me you want to do the same thing as a black person, get tax-exempt statuses. We can go on and on. But there's a lot of things we can track. Go after the Indians. But the thing that's most important, and I'm going to quit, is that you got to understand that reparations are an absolute necessity. We're going to get buried alive. We do not have enough to be able to compete in this society. And the further we get away from the civil rights movement, the worse things are going to get. And when people start talking about slavery, don't just talk about slavery. Talk about Jim Crow slavery and benign neglect. You got to understand what slavery was. Slavery is the illegitimate child of racism. Racism still exists. That's slavery. Because what racism does, racism keeps and maintains what was created by slavery. Now, racism is a competitive economic struggle between groups of people for power and wealth. And it's slavery, and racism never existed until the 16th century. And when slavery went out of existence, racism took over. Racism has gone from meaning slavery to being something biological. Then it moved on, and by the 1800s, it turned to be something as a personal behavior or an attitude, and now a bias and a prejudice. Racism has nothing to do with attitudes, with prejudice, and with bias. Racism is a competitive group contest between people for race, resources, and for superiority. And racism is a race without a finish line. I thank you very much.
Do we have a panel here or what?